The Flatus Show is brought to you by Douglas Brothers Apple Pectin Pea Powder Organic Soap, cleansing and rejuvenating hands and faces since 1923.
This podcast is a proud member of the Network of One Podcast. And also the Freak Network at thefreaknetwork.com.
On today's Bill of the Flatus Show, 142, Minotaurs, Toll Booths, Human Will, and Buckshot. All of this and more. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. A low-calorie carbonated beverage for my diet. Delicious, kids. A low-calorie carbonated beverage. Though today it's not seltzer water, and it's not low-calorie. It's Moxie. It's sugared Moxie. But the reason why I bought it is because I do like the taste of Moxie, and I just wanted a little bit. So these little 8-ounce cans of Moxie, I bought some for a couple dollars just to have occasionally. It's delicious. Moxie. Delicious. Welcome to the Flatus Show. How are you kids been doing? It's been a couple weeks since last we spoke. And I'll give you a little update of what happened. The weekend, Memorial Day weekend, John and I drove down to Philadelphia, to see my sister and her family. And, you know, I especially wanted to see my nephews. One is 8, and the other one is 1.5 years. And let me tell you, he is cute. He is as cute as the Dickens. I love him. I love them both. I love both of my nephews. We had a really great little vacationette, and I have video, which I haven't even taken out of my camera yet, which I'll post videos for all you to see. Let's see what else is there. Let me tell you a little bit about the trip. Normally, when we go down to Philadelphia, we go 95 to the Tappan Zee Bridge and then take the New Jersey Garden State Parkway to the Turnpike, New Jersey Turnpike. But there was a big backup at the Tappan Zee Bridge, so we went straight through 95 to the George Washington Bridge, which I've only done once, and it was in the rain, and I remember being anxious about it, so I sort of avoid it. However, it was really nice. It was, you know, you go through the Bronx Parkway and stuff, and where else do you go through? You go through the town that the Petries live in. What the hell name town is that? Cynthia Ozick lives there, too, or used to live there. Anyway, you drive through there. You drive through the Bronx. They take the George Washington Bridge. I have a video, I took some video of that. Very interesting bridge. I like that. Almost as much as the Tappan Zee Bridge. And, Johnny was driving at that point, and we were on a part of the highway, which was, you know, several highways, you know, and then you have to take exits to go to your highway. So 95, there's this point where there's a V in the road, and Johnny goes straight, and, 95 is to the right. I'm like, Johnny, that was 95 there. You had to make a right. He goes, no, this is it. We find out that it wasn't it. It was Route 80 or something like that. And it was a backup. We were backed up in traffic for about a half hour. So we got through and ended up not taking us too far out of our way. We ended up on the Garden State Parkway. And, you know, we ended up on the New Jersey Turnpike. So that wasn't so bad. On the way home, it was horrendous. We left Sunday night at 10:30, and we were. It was fine. It was. The reason why we did this is to avoid traffic. Okay. We got to a toll booth in New Jersey, and it took more than 45 minutes to get through the tolls. All of the toll booths, like most of them, had this, you know, that fast pass, and a couple of them only had cash. Well, I mean, people are traveling. They don't have fast passes, you know, they're different states. So, you know, we were there for 45 minutes. It was very annoying. So we get past that, and we're driving, fine, you know, no problems, no traffic, going through northern New Jersey. We get to the toll that allows us to go over the George Washington Bridge. Another 45-minute wait. And people were zipping up ahead of us, and it was just annoying, the whole thing. It was just terribly annoying. So we pay for the toll, get past it, and then we come to another toll, but it's not real toll. It's just this, like, I don't know what it is, but to get onto the bridge, you know, sort of backed up. So we finally get past that, and once we got past that, we got home by 6:30, so it was, what, 8 hours. I think that if we hadn't, you know, if we hadn't been stuck with the tolls, right, we would have been home in 6 hours instead of 8. And that's really good. That's really good time for travel between Boston and Philadelphia. So then we come back and, you know, have our day. Monday we had the day off. Go to work. And then the rest of the week, that's this past week, was Johnny in an accident, which you'll hear about later. And you can listen to his side of it on the Deep Forest podcast, and it was really scary. I mean, this is a moment in time where, you know, John could have been dead. It's really scared me. We have to get together our things. We have to get a will. We have to do things to make sure that there is no problems. Now, luckily, John had me down as next of kin when he had gone there the last time. So the doctors had no problems talking to me. I had no problem seeing him. And I don't expect any kind of problems with his family or with my family. But, you know, you have to have these things in place. Because one day you're in a nice relationship and a partner and everything. Next day, one of you are dead. And it just, you know, life is fragile. It's also really resilient. But things can happen at a time. But, you know, that's not the half of it, because we talk about it later in this podcast. I don't want to rehash, but just remember, life is fragile. And take advantage of every moment and don't be a cunt. And I'm using that in the same word way as I would say don't be a prick, okay? It means don't be an asshole, okay? So I'm not making anything bad. I'm not saying anything bad about the female part of our race, because, you know, the prick is the male part of our race, and that means the same thing, okay? Okay. So get over yourself, Mary. So, yeah, don't be an asshole. You know, love one another. Jesus said. Now, universalism. You know, I was reading about the Unitarian Universalist. I like them even more and more and more. I was also reading. I got this book from the dump. Where else do I get my books? It's called The Future of the Human Mind by George H. Estabrooks and Nancy Gross. And it's an engrossing study of the potential powers of the mind in light of recent scientific discoveries. And it's very similar in scope that Doris Lessing's The Prisons of the Prisoner of Your Mind. What is it? What's that book? I kept on touting it. Now I don't remember the title of it. You know, Don't Be a Prisoner. The Prisons That We Keep, or something like that. prisons in our mind or whatever it is. You know, go look. Go look at it. So anyway, this book, it's terrible because it has mildew on it, but that's okay. It's biblically unsound, really. I should burn it and, you know, and curse it, right? So let me read you the dust jacket. What day of the week was August 25th, 1919? What was the date of the first Friday in November of 1903? There are those who can give the answers to these questions before you and I would have time to reach for the almanac. In this unusually engrossing and enlightening book, George H. Estabrooks and Nancy E. Gross reveal many unusual and provocative cases of the extraordinary powers of the human mind and explore the numerous ways they can be sharpened and put to use in the future. Today, the human mind contains resources that most people barely tap. We know, for example, that so-called lightning calculators, who may be simple-minded in other respects, can solve mentally in seconds complex mathematical problems that would take trained mathematicians many times longer to work out, even with the aid of calculating machines. Hypnotism can induce a subject to do in 10 seconds mental work that would take half an hour in normal state. And a slight stimulation of the brain can bring about total recall of experiences long since forgotten by the conscious mind. These and numerous other aspects of psychology, including time distortion, memory stimulation, the conscious and unconscious mind, tapping the subconscious mind for creative purposes, mind-body relationships, and psychosomatic medicine, electronic brains or computers, and the paranormal and extrasensory perception are all new and fascinating keys to the wonders and mysteries of the mind. Man's mind, in his most important possession and scientific interest in its man's mind is his most important possession, and scientific interest in its potential has never been keener or more widespread than it is today. Brilliantly written and highly stimulating, The Future of the Human Mind is an exciting, open-minded approach to the new avenues that are opening towards a fuller realization of mankind's marvelous potentials for creativity and happiness. And I just read some of it, okay? But what was really fascinating was let's talk about hypnosis. This is the last chapter, okay? Some say that you have to be hypnotized, you have to be simple-minded, that you can willfully stop yourself from being hypnotized. And there was an experiment that showed that the person can be hypnotized whether they like it or not. That's one thing, okay? And this can happen on a mass scale as well as you know, one-on-one. Another thing is, apparently, you hear in hypnosis, and I've been reading about hypnosis. It says here that you can't be told, you can't be hypnotized to do something that you wouldn't normally do, that would go against your values. And that is completely false. Because, they have examples, you know, in here. There's actually an example where it was the United States Army, or one of the military, hypnotized a man to kill somebody. And what it was based on their values. Okay, this guy wouldn't necessarily normally kill, right? But what he was given, how he was hypnotized to kill, was he was told that the person you're going to kill is a Japanese dirty Jap. They used that. I'm not saying anything bad about Japanese, okay? This is during World War II. It's a dirty Jap, and he just killed your mother, and, you know, that's just how they set it up. Well, in his mind, he thought it was okay to kill the Jap, so he went after this guy who he thought was the dirty Jap because they made this colonel the dirty Jap, and the guy started strangling the colonel or whatever. Finally, they pulled him off and put him under and, you know, got him out of that. But it just goes to show that you can be hypnotized to do things which you normally wouldn't do in a normal everyday. However, what it shows is that people, there are no set values that we have. right? There are always values can change under certain circumstances. So you might not think it is a let's talk about stealing, right? You might say, okay, stealing, right? I don't want to steal, right? I'm not going to steal. That's wrong. But suppose you were really, really hungry. You had no food, no money, and no food. You might justify it at that point. You know, you could justify it to yourself that I need to survive, so I want to steal food. So these values that we hold, these values that, you know, keep society in check, can change depending on our situation. You know what I'm saying? Depending on the environment. So I just find that interesting. And it said here that the only way that people can be... they said this nurse, right, who was hypnotized against her will. She said she felt like she was raped, okay? And what they did is after that they did this to her, they actually gave her a post hypnotic suggestion, a post hypnotic suggestion that would allow her to resist any kind of hypnosis unless she wanted it. And that's, you know, basically what it is. It's just that what it shows is that the human mind, regardless of who you are, is much more susceptible than you think. And that is very important to be aware of your conduct, what you're thinking, to scrutinize everything. Because that's the only way you're going to know. The only way you're going to know that you are, you know, you're not doing something you don't want to do, okay? So, I mean, and that's, you know, I've talked about this before in the Felicia. That's why it's important to develop a set of values. And that's one thing I have started developing and thinking about since doing the podcast. Talking about things, which I normally didn't do. I think that's one of the best things about podcasting is that you develop a way of looking at the world, you thinking about the world, thinking about all these different subjects and setting values, right? I think it's really important to set values. The religious right is always talking about that. And I think the neocons are, to a certain extent, are that way too. You know, they want one set of values. And maybe this is because of the research that, you know, came out of, you know, in the past. You know, we're talking about the 40s, 50s, and 60s with this, you know, hypnosis and mind control. You know, the neocons, that is, if I think correctly, I mean, that guy was developing that theory or whatever at the same time. And I think he died in the early 70s, the main guy. I forget his name. I should know that. But, you know, I don't know. What do you think? So all I'm saying is, and I always say this, is think for yourself, beware. You know, I think I bet you could take somebody like Steve Webb, who is, you know, this Christian guy, right? And turn him into something that he would not, turn him into an atheist with hypnosis. I bet you. You could do that. Turn Steve Webb into an atheist. You know? I think... Okay, let me tell you also something else, because all this information has come to me at the same time. And I think it's important. The other day I was reading an article in the Phoenix. That's a alternative paper here in the Boston area. And... I forget what he was said, but he said the worst thing that has happened to America because, oh yeah, Kennedy, you know, had his, he was part of the, Jello Biafra was part of the Dead Kennedys, and it's a group, punk group, and, you know, Kennedy was, Edward Kennedy was just diagnosed with a brain tumor. Well, Michael Savage, I think it's Michael Savage, he's a right-wing guy, played one of the Dead Kennedy songs about, you know, in using it to highlight that, you know, the Kennedys are going to be dead. Jello Biafra didn't mean that. You know, he wasn't meaning to, you know, say that the Kennedys should be dead. He wasn't trying to. That wasn't his meaning, okay? And Michael Savage used it out of context. Now, the thing is, Jello Biafra said, what is the problem with this is that in 1980s, the Democrats failed to uphold this law, which had been in effect for 50 years, which basically said that if you own a station, like a radio station, a television station, and you have somebody has a view, right, and they speak it, if there is an opposing view, you have to give that person equal time to say their side of the story, which I think is really a part should be – that's American, right? Isn't that democratic? Because we own the airwaves, Americans, together. We have the rights to the airwaves. It's ours. You know, they're leased, I think, to the broadcasters, right? I think that should go back into effect. Because what has happened since the time, since that was eliminated, right? That law was eliminated because of fucking Reagan, that cocksucker. What it is you have right-wing radio, right, which has taken over. This, no wonder the right-wing, the religious right has grown. Because you have just one view. You don't have, they're not required to have any other views. They can say whatever they want. You know they lie. You know, and now, you know, it's like, you know, you have left-wing radio, you have right-wing radio. How about just playing radio with all different ideas, right? But what has happened is, it's become polarized, and this right-wing radio has taken over, you know? And so you don't have the voices. You don't have all the voices of America. It's like stormtroopers coming in, and all you have is propaganda. You know, Rush Limbaugh and all those other assholes are propagandists. That's all they are. And they're not journalists. They're not saying anything new. They're propagandists. And they're trying to manipulate and undermine American democracy. So we need to put that law back into effect. That, you know, any station, I don't care if you're a Christian station, if you're going to say something and somebody disagrees with you, you have to give them equal time on your station to say the truth, to refute it, because the American public deserves that, right? The American public deserves that. There are certain areas in this country where you only get one kind of radio station or two. You're limited with your choices. That's all the information you're going to get. That's wrong. And so Congress has to get their ass moving and get that law back into effect. Let me tell you. Okay? And, you know, we need to do a lot of other things, too. But that specifically. Now, luckily, with podcasting, people can, you know, say what they want, and that's really good. And as you know, on my podcast, if you disagree or have anything to say, I'll be glad to give you equal time to talk. Okay? And I don't mind doing that. Equal time, you know. But, you know, let's keep it under 5 minutes. Because I tend to ramble on. So I'm not going to be, you know, podcasting your 80-minute show, okay? You know. I'll say this. You have, you know, 10-minute response, which you have to pay, which I have to, you know, which I'll put in there. 10-minute response, that's fine. Up to 10 minutes, if you have something to say. And of course, you know, comments I trust them. You know, I have them all the time. But if you don't agree with me, then say, you know, send me something. I'll play it. You know, because I believe in that, and I think we have to get this back on the books. Okay, these fucking people in government, they're assholes. Assholes, I tell you, assholes. Anyway, on with the show.
Woman is fickle, a fossil, together moves like a feather, borne on the breezes. Woman with witching smile will ever deceive you, often will grieve you, yet as she pleases. Her heart unfeeling, Fossil together moves like a feather. Borne on the breeze, borne on the breeze, borne, yes, borne on the breeze. Wretched the dupe is when she looks kindly, trusts to her blindly, his life thus wasting. Yet must he surely be dull beyond measure, who of love's pleasure never has been tasting. Woman unfeeling, fossil together, moves like a feather. Borne on the breeze, borne on the breeze, borne, yes, borne on the breeze.
Harrison Birtwistle. Hi, kids. This is Kenty, as you know. And I'm going to give you a little talk about Harrison Birtwistle. He's an English composer. And he is, I don't know, 70-something now. He's born 1934, so that makes him 74. He's contemporary with Peter Maxwell Davies, if you know that name. When I was working at the music store, I was interested in modern music. And specifically, I was interested in modern American music and modern American opera, which was hard to find. I'll tell you that. It was difficult to find. In fact, there was only the recordings that I remember finding was Barber's Vanessa. And that's Samuel Barber, his opera Vanessa, which is tonal, it's actually kind of interesting harmonically, because I played a song off of it on my ukulele, one of the arias, and it has interesting harmonies, but what one would call tonal, and his opera Cleopatra, which was on New World Records. Now, New World Records and CRI, those were two labels which specialized in American music, in contemporary American music. So anything to be found was to be found on those labels. Most American operas, most of the modern American operas were short pieces. Because of this dearth of, I think dearth is the right word, of American opera to be had, to be listened to, I went for the British, and there's plenty more British opera that was available on LP. Britain was one, though he's tonal. I mean, it's challenging. Some of his operas are very challenging, but what I especially liked was Tippett, Michael Tippett. Now, he is dead now. He was a generation ahead. He's the same generation as Britain, I believe. He was born like 1913, okay? And Peter Maxwell Davies and Birtwistle, they were born in the 30s, okay? So we're talking the next generation after Tippett and Britten. And so, you know, there, of course, were the Tippett operas and the Britten operas, which were recorded. And I snatched those up. And then I found the Britten and the Birtwistle and then Peter Maxwell Davies. And the first Birtwistle piece I bought was Punch and Judy. It's an opera based on the puppet play. It's a British seaside entertainment. Apparently it's, you go to the British seaside and they have Punch and Judy shows. And it's very gruesome and very violent. And what one of the reasons why I bought the opera was because it had my favorite singer, Jen DiGattani, plus Phil's Bryn Julsen was in it, and Philip Langridge was in it, John Tomlinson was in it. All of these great people who, you know, I came to know because of their recordings of modern music. Now, not necessarily opera, but other things, you know, chamber pieces, songs. These are the names that stuck out. And they were the ones I collected because I knew that they performed modern music and they did it well. At least I thought they did it well. I mean, I can't really tell you, but I'm pretty sure that they were excellent at what they did. And I'm pretty sure that even if I didn't know that they were singing the, let's say I was listening to a singer and they weren't singing the right notes, I think I could tell, even though it's a new piece. I think you can tell a bad singer from a good singer, even if you don't know the piece. I don't know if that makes sense, but so anyway, Punch and Judy was the first opera, and no one was listening to Punch and Judy. You know, a friend of mine, Ted, he's actually the first one who gave me a copy of it. He had it on LP. It had been long out of print by the time I had been at the record store. So he let me borrow it, and I recorded it on tape. And I listened to that tape over and over and over and over again. I think it fit on like one 100-minute tape. And I listened to it constantly, and it was at the same time that I was in the chorus of MAME in the Musical Theater of Abington. They did MAME, and I was in the chorus. And I remember hearing parts of Punch and Judy sounding like MAME. Like, there's these interludes in MAME. There's this tableau where MAME is going through town, and she's a fireman, and I forget what else there is. It's all musical. And there's parts of that which remind me of Punch and Judy. And I always associate MAME with Punch and Judy because I was listening to it at that time. And so Harrison Birtwistle, you know, was unknown, but, you know, he has become known. He's actually now respected. And he's written quite a few operas, too. I mean, Punch and Judy was in 1967. And he wrote an opera called The Mask of Orpheus in 1984, and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in 1990. Now, those two I knew about for a long time, and I've been looking for, you know, copies of them. I think Gawain had been recorded. The Mask of Orpheus was not recorded at that time. Now, I moved to Boston in 92, and of course there was HMV, which I was hoping I could find all these great operas. And I did, for the most part, found a lot of interesting things. And I don't think I ever ended up buying Gawain and the Green Knight or Mask of Orpheus because they were too damn expensive. Though I eventually did get a copy of them. But you know what? I'll tell you what, kids. I don't really recall what they sound like. I never got into it. When I listened to Gawain and or Mask of Orpheus, I just couldn't get into it. I really got back into Birtwistle when I started recording operas off of, you know, off the radio, on the internet. The BBC has a wonderful, wonderful broadcasting. I love BBC, the BBC Three. And that is where I heard his fourth opera called The Second Mrs. Kong, which is to do with Vermeer's, the girl with a pearl earring and pearl necklace or whatever, Vermeer and King Kong and celluloid things. It's very interesting. And I have a recording of that. I recorded it off the radio and I've listened to it several times. I like it a lot. It's very difficult to listen to. I wish I had a libretto because it's layered. He wrote another opera after that in 2000 called The Last Supper. And most recently in 2008 was Minotaur. The Minotaur, which was premiered at Covent Garden, and it was just on the BBC. They just this past weekend, actually yesterday, that was Saturday, the last of the month, May 31st, broadcasted it. I wasn't even looking for opera. It was like Friday afternoon, and I was, oh, I'm going to look at the opera listing because I haven't done that for a while. And here I find that what is being broadcast is this brand new opera by Birtwistle, Minotaur. I was like, I'm there. I'm going to record it. and that's that. And I did. What was really heartbreaking too is at the same time another station was broadcasting Stockhausen's opera Montag aus Licht, which I really want to have. So I'm hoping that they repeat the performance. Or if anybody out there has recorded Montag aus Licht, Stockhausen's a German composer. He recently died. Same period, same age as Bert Whistle and Peter Maxwell Davies, same generation. Maybe a little older. He might have been born in 1928, actually. I think he's 10 years older than the Bert Whistle and Peter Maxwell Davies. So the Minotaur was really interesting. I recorded it. I'm going to play a little bit of it for you, 2 minutes of it, to give you an idea of what he sounds like. But if you kids are really interested in Bert Whistle, and I hope you are, go and listen to it, Punch and Judy, because the English National Opera has performed Punch and Judy this spring, and it's going to be broadcast on the BBC Three on June 21st. Look for details at bbc.co.uk/radio for details, but it'll be on June 21st. I hope to remember that it's on so I can record it, so I can have another recording of Punch and Judy, which I will love to have. So that's it about Bert Whistle. But, oh, yeah, let me tell you something really interesting. Apparently, you know, he was unknown, basically. Bert Whistle was ignored until the 90s. And what happened was Covent Garden decided to do his opera Gawain and the Green Knight again. And I'm reading this off of Wikipedia. Let me just get the information. Revival of Gawain at the Royal Opera House, okay? It was 1994. And there's this guy, Frederick Stockton, an anti-modernist music guy. He hated anything modern. He had a group called the Hecklers, and they came and bought tickets. And at the very end, they all booed and catcalled and did what they had to do. However, their behavior actually created this scandal, and everybody wanted to see Gawain and the Green Knight. And you know what? They ended up liking Bert Whistle. And so there you go, you know? And since then, he's written, well, since 1994, let's see, that was the year of that he wrote The Second Mrs. Kong. So, you know, since then, he's written 3 more operas and tons of other stuff. So go for it, Mr. Bert Whistle. I love you. I loved your music since I was able to listen to it in the 80s. But it was the early music. Because you know that's what it was, is that all of the music, all the modern music I was listening to in the 80s was written in the 60s. It wasn't recorded until the 80s, you know, or like the 70s, you know, like all the stuff from the past was eventually available, you know. It was like at a certain point, recording companies stopped recording modern music, you know. It was terrible. Except for Nonesuch. They did a good job the whole time through.
In happy moments day by day, the sands of life may pass in swift but tranquil tide away from time's unerring glass. Yet hopes we used as bright to deem, remembrance will recall, whose pure and whose unfading beam is dearer far than all, whose pure and whose unfading beam is dearer far than all. Though anxious eyes upon us gaze, and hearts with fondness beat, whose smile upon each feature plays with truthfulness replete. Some thoughts none other can replace. Remembrance will recall, which in the flight of years we trace, is dearer far than all, which in the flight of years we trace, is dearer far than all.
So, Thursday afternoon, around 3 o'clock, I get a phone call at work. It's a strange woman. She says, "May I speak to Ken Steffler?" I'm like, "This is Ken Steffler." "Well, your friend wanted me to tell you that he's here at the hospital." I'm like, "Who? What do you mean, friend?" I said, "John Robinson." And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, what happened?" "Well, he had a little accident on his scooter. And he's okay. The bleeding has stopped. And he'll be going into surgery." I'm like, "What?" "Well, I really can't give you much more information." I said, "Well, I didn't know what to do." So I said, "Well, I'll be right there, you know." So I'm like beside myself. I was like, I don't know what's going on or what happened. And I'm thinking, you know, I have to try to call somebody else, you know, like Kathy, his sister and his mother. Call his mother. And I find out I do not have their numbers on my cell phone.
Do you now?
I do now. Yeah. So I end up going on the train, going home early. I left early, an hour early. And I called a friend of mine, Diane, who talked to her partner, Sylvia, and they set up a ride for me to come home from the train so I can, you know, get home and change, feed Jose, and get to the hospital. So I'm at home. I'm trying to find the phone numbers for Gilead and Kathy. I still don't know, you know, who knows about what has happened. And so I'm running around the house, and I was here for about an hour, 6 o'clock, because I asked Sylvia if she wanted to come up. She said she's working. So I'm running around trying to find the numbers. I can't find the numbers, and I get a call from Kathy. "We're at the hospital." I'm like, "Well, that's good that you're there. I mean, Johnny called me right after the accident."
I called my mother.
Yeah, well, called his mother.
Yeah.
And I found out, because I hung up from her, and I said, "Well, I'll be right up to the hospital, you know. Now that I know that I don't need to call you." I get a call from John's friend, Susan. I'm just returning a call. John called me on the cell phone. I'm like, he called everybody on his cell phone but me. The nurse had to call me. No, you didn't. The nurse called me.
Oh.
So, Johnny was, you know, called Susan, his friend. But the good thing is that the hospital has me down as next of kin.
Yeah.
When Johnny was there the last time. So,
see, the thing, I guess I thought that you were already taken care of when the nurse said she was going to call you. And then someone took my cell phone out of my pocket while I was, like, waiting to bleed to death. And I called all these other people before I...
You called the people?
I think I did. Yeah.
You must have. I don't know when you called these people, but you didn't. I don't think you called me first. Because you didn't call me. The nurse called me.
Right.
I thought you were unconscious.
Uh-huh.
He could have bled to death, and the full story could be found at the Dark Forest podcast at thedarkforest.blogspot.com, right?
I could have bled to death.
He could have bled to death. Now, so Johnny, I go to the hospital. He's yellow, you know, he's just come out of operation. But he's like, "Get this damn thing off my neck." He had this brace around his neck. He's kind of cranky. But we calmed them down because they didn't know if anything else was wrong with them, right? He could have hurt his neck, you know. But nothing else was wrong, except that he had this freak accident where he he was on his motorbike. What do they call them? Scooter.
Motor scooter.
He was on his motor scooter.
Yeah.
And he hit the accelerator. He went flying over the handlebars. The left mirror broke off and ripped through his bicep and his part of his pectoral.
Pectoralis.
Mm-hmm. And he could have bled to death. There was an old man there, John said, who didn't know what to do. Somebody did come out and give him a towel, but Johnny knew enough to put pressure on that. And then the ambulance came and got him to the hospital in 17 minutes.
I called the ambulance myself.
Yeah, Johnny called the ambulance himself. I would have bled to death.
And
I would have been like a dying roadkill.
I said this on my own show, too, but I also had the sense to put pressure on the wound myself.
That's what I said, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he knows, he worked for it. I wouldn't have known that. And I talked to my neighbor, he said he would have bled to death, too. We would have been like, I would have been like an opossum on the side of the road, mm-hmm. bleeding to death. But Johnny got to the hospital, and...
It's a flashback. I'm having a flash.
John's having a flashback. But he looks real good now. His color has come back, but he lost 4 pints of blood.
Count them.
Count them. 4 pints of blood. I think there are only 11 pints in the body.
See, I think that there are 5 quarts of blood in the body.
Well, 5 quarts is 10 pints.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
okay.
So I think there's 10 to 11 pints of blood in the body. That's what somebody told me. And so he's back. He's very bruised. I should take a picture of it for the flight of show artwork.
No.
I should take a picture of your drain.
Looks like a grenade.
Yeah, he has a grenade hanging out of him.
It looks like a transparent grenade.
Yeah, filled with liquid.
And it's good. Do you want me to talk about that? Or?
If you want, yeah. What's it called?
It's called a Jackson Pratt drain.
How long have they been around?
I don't know. But the way they work is there's a tube that goes into the wound, and then it comes out, and it goes into this drain.
Uh-huh.
Kathy doesn't want to look at it, so I'll cut
it. Yeah, I don't have to look at it. No.
and then it's this sort of grenade-shaped thing, which you squeeze the air out of, and then you close the top. There's like a little stopper on the top, and you close it, which creates suction, so the drain sucks out blood and lymphatic fluid or whatever is in the wound. And then when it fills up, you empty it and squeeze it and then put the stopper on again.
And the reason why that is done is to reduce the chance of infection.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Now, the doctor talked to me. Actually, this is another good thing about the hospital and the way they, you know, who they're talking to. But after the operation was over, I was on the train, and he called my cell phone. The doctor told me he's good. He's out of the operation. He's in recovery.
I wonder how he got your cell phone number.
Because I gave it to them. I gave it to the nurse.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They called my work number, then I gave him the cell phone.
Uh-huh.
He's a very nice Dr. K.
Kakianis.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I'm not supposed to say names?
I don't know. You can, I guess. Yeah. You know. If you want. I just say Dr. K.
Yeah.
Whatever. Anyway, Dr. K. And
Special K?
Special K. So Dr. K, oops, sorry, Dr. K called me on the phone. The first thing, I get kind of queasy when you talk about blood and stuff like that. So he's on the phone. He's chatting away. He's a vein surgeon, right?
Vascular
surgeon.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, it looked like hamburger meat in there. I'm like, oh. All I could think of was, you know, Chuck Grade A. Ground beef, you know, but he apparently it was really bad. He lost part of his bicep.
Didn't you see some hamburger meat on the scooter
when you brought it? Oh, yeah. So the next day, since they took the scooter to a towed it away, $166 later, we had to go pick it up. And I'm in there, it's dark, and the guy says, oh, is that the guy with the scooter? How's he doing? I'm like, he's fine. I said, and I saw that one of the mirrors is missing. I said, yeah, apparently that went through his bicep. Oh, yeah, we saw his tendons on there. I'm like, ooh. One guy got sick.
At the garage?
Yeah, at the garage. Who picked it up. So I didn't even see that. And he says, I said, can you put something over it, like a paper towel? Because I don't want to look at it when I get to the sunlight. So I wheel it out. Actually, I got
to see it. Did they do that?
They did, but I fell off and I got to see it.
What color was it?
It was dried. It was like a mummy meat. It was like beef jerky stuck to So Johnny's famous bicep beef jerky is stuck to the bike. It was smashed. I don't know if it's rideable or not. I want Johnny to just take it to the, you know, dumpster and get rid of it. Just get rid of the fucking bike.
I haven't made a decision about that yet, but, you know.
Next time you don't get any sympathy.
Yeah.
I ripped through my right bicep this time.
Well, you know, I don't have very big biceps to begin with.
I know. I know. I have big biceps.
It's probably gone, you know.
You have to have something there.
I have to have physical therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unbelievable. So, okay, so this is the lesson to be learned, okay? Because at the Flatus Show, we like to have a moral to the story.
Mm.
Johnny, you want to tell them what you should not do, what you should do,
yeah,
and what you did and what you should not do?
Yeah, sure. See, you misrepresented a little bit what happened. What happened was I wasn't actually riding. It wasn't actually moving when this happened.
You're straddled, though.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to make a turn because I came to a detour in this narrow road, and I wanted to turn around and go the other way. So I was going very slowly and trying to make a turn around and go back. And the scooter kind of lost its balance because it was going slowly, and it wanted to go lie down, so I let it lie down. And so I was straddling it. And then I reached down with my left hand. I reached down with my right hand, put my right hand on the right handlebar to pull the scooter back up. Well, that's where the accelerator is. So, inadvertently, I accelerated as I was pulling it up from the ground, and it just took off and flew into this car that was passing by at the time, into the driver's side car. So, the lesson to be learned is, if you put your scooter down, make sure you turn the ignition off.
Before picking it up.
Before picking it up. That's the lesson to be
learned. Otherwise, you could lose your life.
Yeah. I'm lucky, Johnny, to be here.
Johnny is very lucky. You want to talk about the coincidences?
Oh, yeah.
Well, because this is sort of, you know, strange thing.
It's strange that...
makes you think about life.
I was... I got up in the... I forget when it was. Like, yesterday sometime. And I was looking for my email. And there was an email from Daniel. You all know who Daniel is. I know who he is, right?
His lover.
And,
His lover!
Oh, shh. So, I got an email from Daniel saying that he needed to chat with me. And it had this kind of ring to it that was, you know,
urgent
ring to it. So I went on Skype and found him there, and turns out his best friend Juan died of a heart attack.
And this is the day after
Johnny
had, because I had emailed Daniel,
right? So Daniel was like fit to be, you know, he was a mess because he was worried about me, and his friend Juan died, and it was just so strange. And then, was it the next day?
No, it was the same day.
Same day?
Your first day home, Saturday.
I decided to call my friend Leslie, and if you listen to The Dark Forest, you heard a message from Leslie, and she was someone that I had had a falling out with, and we recently reconnected. And so I called her just to chat with her and tell her what was going on with me. And her son answered the phone, which was strange, because he doesn't live there. And so what happened to Leslie? She had a massive stroke. Massive stroke. Paralyzed one side of her body, can't talk, can't eat. And so there are three. And you know, I thought to myself, I can't handle this.
Yeah.
But I was. I do. I am.
You were very lucky.
I was lucky, yeah. Yeah. Sylvia said that, our friend Sylvia said that, you know, I was talking to her, trying to decide how to interpret all this stuff, you know, and she said, life is fragile and you were lucky. So I guess that's really the truth, you know.
Absolutely. I was lucky.
Sometimes life is fragile and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's really incredibly tough and resilient.
Oh, yeah.
It isn't fragile all the time.
It is fragile, but it's also resilient. Yeah. Human body can go through a lot.
You know, I'm always...
But you go past that certain thing, right? And you're dead.
Yeah.
You know? You only have so much.
Yeah.
It's like 9 lives of cat.
Looking back on this accident, I feel like I brought a lot of, I guess the only word is strength, you know, a lot of strength to the experience, you know, knowing what to do and, you know, just trying to hold on and be calm, stay calm and so on, you know, while on the side of the road and in the ambulance and in the hospital.
I wonder what little Audrey would have done.
Little Audrey. She would have laughed and laughed
and laughed because all the time she knew.
Something.
Something.
Another 5-minute mystery. Late afternoon in a small seaboard town, and in an old-fashioned house, old Doc Tucker is resting in his office, waiting for his housekeeper to bring him a cup of his beloved black coffee.
Doc Tucker, if you don't quit using that new operating table for a couch, if you knew how it scares a body to walk in here and see you stretched out there.
Better than a couch, Carrie. It's adjustable. Long as I was foolish enough to buy this contraption, I might as well...
I'll get it, Doctor.
Is there a doctor here? I saw the sign. My friend, we were humming, the gun went off.
Good heavens, bring him right in. Doctor!
I'm here, Carrie. Here, young fella, put him right down here. How is he, doctor?
Shotgun can make an awful mess of a man. Doesn't seem to be any buckshot in him, except right here where it almost tore a hole through his chest.
But how is he?
Well, I'm afraid there's not much we can do for you, friend, young fella. He's dead. Feel better now? Sort of keeled over. What's this all about?
My name is Johnson. Bertrand Johnson. His name is Billings. We were partners in business.
I see. I'll have to know what happened for my report.
Well, as I said, we were out hunting near here. That is, he was. Golf is my game. And today, he taught me how to aim and fire a shotgun.
This accident, if you could maybe tell me just how it happened.
As I told you, he'd been showing me how to aim the gun, and then some birds flew out of the bushes up ahead of us, and he told me to go after them.
You only had this one gun between you?
Yes, Billings owned it.
So you went after the birds?
Every time I got near them, they flew away. I kept following them. I guess I must have lost track of direction. I saw something move in a bush and shot at it. It was Billings.
How could you make a mistake like that?
I don't know. But the bush was very thick, and it was so far away.
Far away?
It must have been at least 50 yards.
Excuse me. Carrie, can you come in here a minute?
Yes, doctor.
Here, Carrie, I want you to make a phone call. Number is on this slip of paper.
Now, I'll leave my name and address, doctor, and the name of my partner's wife. If you could telephone her before I attempt to break the news.
It won't be necessary. Your name and address, I mean.
I don't understand.
That was the sheriff I asked Carrie to get on the phone. Until he gets here, I'm holding you for murder.
What makes the doctor suspect that what appears to be a typical hunting accident is deliberate murder? Do you know the clue? We'll learn in a moment, but first...
You've no right to accuse me like this.
A little while ago, young fella, you were asking me how bad your friend was hurt, as if you didn't know. Then you told me Billings was behind a bush about 50 yards away when this accident happened. Anybody who knows about shotguns knows that the farther away the target is, the more the pattern of buckshot spreads out. The pattern of buckshot in Billings' body proves that it was no accident. that you couldn't have been more than a few feet from him when you pulled the trigger. No, my friend, your alibi missed its mark.
Henry W. Longfellow, My Lost Youth. Often I think of the beautiful town that is seated by the sea. Often in thought go up and down the pleasant streets of that dear old town. And my youth comes back to me, and in a verse of Lapland song is haunting my memory still. A boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. I can see the shady lines of its trees, and catch in sudden gleams the sheen of the far surrounding seas and islands that were the Hesperides. Of all my boyish dreams and the burden of that old song, it murmurs and whispers still, a boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. I remember the black wharves and the slips, and the sea tides tossing free, and the Spanish sailors with bearded lips, and the beauty and mystery of the ships, and the magic of the sea, and the voice of that wayward song is singing and saying still, a boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. I remember the bulwarks by the shore, and the fort upon the hill, the sunrise gun with its hollow roar, and the drum beat repeated o'er and o'er, and the bugle wild and shrill, and the music of that old song throbs in my memory still. A boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. I remember the sea fight far away, how it thundered o'er the tide, and the dead captains, as they lay in their graves o'erlooking the tranquil bay, where they in battle died. And the sound of that mournful song goes through me with a thrill. A boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. I can see the breezy domes of groves, the shadows of Deering's Wood, and the friendships old and the early loves come back with a Sabbath sound, as of doves in quiet neighborhoods, and the verse of that sweet old song, it flutters and murmurs still, a boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. I remember the gleams and glooms that dart across the schoolboy's brain, the song and the silence in the heart, and in part are prophecies and in part are longings wild and vain, and the voice of that fitful song sings on and is never still. A boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. There are things of which I may not speak. There are dreams that cannot die. There are thoughts that make the strong heart weak, and bring a pallor to the cheek, and a mist before the eye, and the words of that fateful song come over me like a chill. A boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. Strange to me now are the forms I meet when I visit the dear old town. And the native air is pure and sweet, and the trees that o'ershadow each well-known street, as they balance up and down, are singing the beautiful song, and sighing and whispering still, a boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. And Deering's Wood are fresh and fair, and with joy that is almost pain, my heart goes back to wander there, and among the dreams of the days that were, I find my lost youth again, and the strange and beautiful song, the groves are repeating again, a boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts.
You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm.